This Week in Free Energy.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. This is Sterling Allen, your host. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net to see the call-in numbers if you would like to call in. And we ask that you wait till the end of the hour to do that. Our guest this week is Harry Scholl of Cyclone Technology. He is the CEO and the inventor of what is called the Scholl cycle, which is somewhat similar to the Stirling cycle. It's an external combustion engine. Harry, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, maybe I should tell a little bit of a story about how we found out about you guys. We have a page on our website where we talk about another technology that's called a cyclone down in Australia, and we had some comments about maybe that was a little bit of a dubious technology. And one of your, I guess, receptionists was going through and looking at different links into your website, and I had accidentally put a memo on a link to your website thinking it was this company down in Australia saying, you know, kind of buyer beware type of thing. And she saw that and kind of was puzzled by that and got on the phone with me.
Scary, I can tell you.
Yeah. So I found out about you from that, and sounded like you have some really great technology, and you're getting close to taking this to market. So I said, well, why don't you come on the show and tell us about it?
Well, so, we have a quite a unique engine. It's based on a lot of old technology brought up to date, is basically what it is.
Maybe you can tell us just briefly how the technology works in terms of what is the Scholl cycle from a mechanical point of view. How does it work?
Mechanically, it's a piston engine, and it's a radial configuration similar to the old radial aircraft engines, except the crankshaft is vertical and has what we call a spider bearing in the middle, so it can be an even number of cylinders and keep a perfect balance. That's where the engine starts off, as an engine itself, but it's the external combustion. It doesn't have expansion in the cylinder from the gases, explosion of gases. It's external in a heat exchanger that wraps around the top side of the cylinders. We use deionized water as a working fluid, and that's where the Rankine cycle of the system comes in. We heat the deionized water, but we operate at what's called supercritical pressure, whereas it doesn't turn into a steam. It's always into a fluid situation at 3,200 psi and 1,200 degrees. So when a valve opens, it actually explodes on the top of the cylinder, and water is what's in the cylinder, and it goes through ports as in a two-cycle engine, and then goes through another heat exchanger. And that heat exchanger pipes the fluid to the backside of the main heat exchanger. And it's a series of cycles back and forth between heat exchangers. However, what it does, it gives you an engine that's extremely compact and very environmentally friendly, because it's external combustion. And in the external combustion process, the fuel is actually burned in the centrifuge, so the carbon particles and unburned particles always stay to the outer wall until they're consumed, and it also gives you the advantage of using all types of multiple fuels: diesel, gasoline, kerosene, number six, and you can also take these fuels and mix them together, in the same tank. And the other advantage also is the engine is so small, compact, and lightweight that it's less cost to manufacture than a diesel or a comparable gasoline engine. And the other nice advantage is the engine is self-starting and has this maximum torque at 1 RPM. So in an automotive application, you can bolt it directly to the differential and alleviate a transmission, a radiator, a muffler.
Now, with the self-starting, so there's no starting motor required.
It does have a blower, though. The blower is the cooling, like your cooling fan that you would have. And what it does, this blower blows around a centrifugal heat exchanger and takes that heat and pipes that heat through another heat exchanger and then into the combustion chamber. And this is where the Carnot side of the engine comes in, because it uses about 30% of its waste heat is recycled back into the engine itself. Whereas an internal combustion engine, you know, a third of your energy goes out your radiator and another third out your tailpipe. Well, this here takes a third of that energy and pipes it right back into the engine itself instead of wasting it, like a modern power plant.
What is the overall efficiency of the fuel?
Well, of course, it depends what fuel you're using, if your efficiency on a per gallon basis, but we're looking at efficiency somewhere in the middle of diesel. And of course, the higher the efficiency of any internal combustion engine is based on its clearance volume, or you might call the compression ratio of the engine. And this engine has a variable compression ratio, and that's where the diesel cycle of the engine comes in, because we lower the compression ratio where you're operating at very, very low speeds at 1 RPM, and then as it approaches 1,000 RPM, the compression ratio goes up to 27 to 1 compression ratio, which reduces the clearance volume of the engine. By reducing the clearance volume, your efficiencies go up, and by having to reduce that fill space, and that way we can get in the range of diesels on the high end.
When you talk about the engine being extremely compact, you're talking about for the same torque output, your engine is going to be smaller?
Well, the 100 horsepower engine has a weight of about 320 pounds. Now, if we're looking at a 100 horsepower gasoline engine, you might have about the same, maybe a little bit more, in the range of 400 pounds. However, you still have to add your radiator, your transmission, your muffler, catalytic converter, and a lot of ancillary equipment. So in this situation here, you got 320 pounds, which is the complete engine.
And you wouldn't need the transmission because you have a full torque curve?
Right. We'll see a 100 horsepower engine. Normally, they turn very high RPMs, and torque and horsepower are equal at 5252. So a 100 horsepower engine at 5252 would only be 100 foot-pounds of torque. Well, the 100 horsepower Cyclone is 700 foot-pounds of torque at 1 RPM. But the torque speed runs backwards. So at 3600 is the operating speed, you'd have 145 foot-pounds of torque at 3500.
Where you have the optimal torque at the low RPMs, what happens to torque at the high RPMs, which is what you're going to be at for an operational rotation speed going down the highway, for example?
Well, the most of the torque is needed for the acceleration. Horsepower, as you increase your RPMs, you have a different thing. Acceleration needs torque, whereas horsepower starts to be a bigger requirement. as torque and RPMs, the multiple of that is, of course, is horsepower. But as you get into your higher RPMs, as we're talking about a normal 100 horsepower engine, you're still going to peak out at 100 horsepower, because you're dealing with rolling resistance and wind resistance in an automobile. So it would be equal as equal. 100 horsepower is going to be 100 horsepower. However, that little 100 horsepower engine, not having the torque for acceleration, has to go through a gear change. So you bring your RPMs down. You might be turning your little 100 horsepower engine at 5,500, 6,000 RPMs, going through a gear change, and to multiply the torque at the rear wheels. But then you have to keep pulling a flywheel, pulling your gear change to accelerate your car, whereas in the Cyclone, the torque is already at the top end. The difference is if you're going to pull a bow and arrow, where the Cyclone, the bow and string would already be pulled. It's just a matter of letting it go, whereas in a regular internal combustion engine, you have to pull the bowstring back before you can let it go, but you'd have to pull it back and forth several times. going through each gear change. And of course, there's a horsepower loss going through the gear change, you know, in the transmission itself. And a good way to tell how much power loss there is in a transmission is they have oil coolers on them. And if you have heat going through an oil cooler, of course, you have power losses.
Now, in your patent, as I look at the configuration of your engine, there's quite a few moving mechanical parts. How would your engine compare to a regular internal combustion engine?
Well, it has one cam, and it has one lobe on the cam, and it's a tapered cam. And as RPMs increase, the cam travels up and changes its timing and duration. So you eliminate a big long camshaft. There's only one throw on the crankshaft and two actual main bearings, and there's a steady bearing that's all the way down to the bottom, of course. And it only has six valves in it, and no exhaust valve. So if you look at it that way, there's far less moving parts than there is in an internal combustion. The engine block itself on the 100-horse engine only weighs 35 pounds. It has no cords in the block. The cylinders are just sleeves, and of course you've got a rocker arm and a push rod, and your throttle mechanism is a rotating system that has little steady carriages on it to carry the push rods against the rocker arms, and that's your full throttle mechanism. So you don't have an ignition system. It's a steady state ignition system. There's no advance to the timing. Fuel injection is a new type system we developed that burns fuel really, really, really clean. And it doesn't have to be pulsed, it doesn't have to be timed. And the only electronics on the whole system, of course, besides the motor that drives the fuel pump, the blower, is a K-probe thermocouple that operates the temperature of the engine that keeps the heat exchanger at 1,200 degrees, which shuts off when it reaches 1,200 degrees, comes on when it comes out at 1,150 degrees, the thermocouple comes on. So the electronics is very, very simple, and the mechanics and the parts are very simple.
In terms of the governing of the engine, how responsive is it to increases or decreases in the throttle?
Well, far, far faster than what you would expect out of an internal combustion engine, you know, because an internal combustion engine has to start off at, you know, at 600-700 RPMs that it idles at. And below those RPMs, an internal combustion engine won't even run. It's a static engine. So it has to maintain that RPM just to maintain itself. And then if you accelerate it, you have to, you're putting fuel in ahead of itself to try to accelerate, but now you also have to accelerate the flywheel. You have to pull the inertia to build it into the flywheel, pull the gears and the pumps in the transmission and all the accelerator equipment to accelerate the engine. Whereas in the Cyclone, the pressure is already there. It's just like you just have to let it go. It's already ready to use.
Now, you talked earlier about not needing a radiator. So this system doesn't require any kind of coolant?
Well, the cooling is built into the engine because it's a heat exchange system. Whereas in a radiator in a car, a third of that heat or the waste heat of the engine goes out through your radiator, just blowing hot air into the air. Well, on our engine, the lower section of the engine itself is a heat exchanger. However, this heat is reused again. That's what's piped into the combustion chamber.
So what is lost in an internal combustion engine as heat is being harnessed in your system in the function of the system.
Yes, it's reheated into the combustion chamber. The combustion air, instead of ambient air going to the combustion chamber, by the time it goes through the heat exchanger, it goes into the combustion area at around 500 to 550 degrees.
You talk about using different kinds of fuels. Even though technically you could use different fuels, practically, would you be able to have one fuel tank and just put in the fuel tank whatever you have available, whether it's diesel, gasoline, petrol, waste oil. You probably wouldn't want to use waste oil, or could you use waste oil? And could you just throw whatever you have in the tank and it would work just fine?
Yes, absolutely. Unless there are some chemicals that you might have that are not compatible, you wouldn't want to mix acetone and gasoline at any for any long period, because that'll form a what's called a gun cotton and gum everything all up. But gasoline, motor oil, diesel fuel, alcohol, anything that'll mix together. But even if it didn't mix, if they separated, it wouldn't make much difference, because it's an external combustion burner. And it's in an air atomized situation. So what happens is if it's a lower BTU fuel, it just burns for longer.
What about waste oil? Is that too gummy?
Well, we've tried some. The only thing is you don't want to use the synthetic oils. Don't burn well. But the non-synthetic oils you can use. However, there's not going to be that much to burn, because this engine is water lubricated. It has no oil in the engine.
When you say water lubricated, maybe you could explain a little further about that?
The bearings are composite bearings. It's pressure lubricated, however, we use deionized water. And that's absolutely necessary to run what we call a supercritical engine. And we need a supercritical engine to achieve the high efficiency level. The water is actually piped through all the main bearings, the rod bearings, and that's your main lubrication.
Is that being consumed? Do you have to replenish that, or is it a closed system?
Oh, it's a closed system. It's be like your refrigerator in your house. You don't have to touch the lubrication in it. And the reason you have to, of course, in an internal combustion engine, you have explosive gases always going, you know, bypassing your piston rings. And oil, you know, if you have oil on any kind of a surface, it's a dirt collector. And your engine, as it runs, it breathes and it's sucking in air. And that air has contaminants in it, and of course it will, turn your oil black. So 3,000 miles, you have to change it out, go through, and you have to have a series of filters in there. If you can keep a totally clean, closed system, you don't have to change it, because the water just never wears out.
Mm-hmm. Now, you used the word ionized water earlier, and then you're saying deionized water. Maybe you could explain.
Oh, it is deionized water. Excuse me.
Okay.
What that does, it's highly purified. You know, you don't have any particles in it, because, of course, that's what happens to bearings in a regular engine. Any particles in there, of course, wear the bearings.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the particles to wear, and the deionization of the water stops the oxidation of the materials in the engine, you know, because the condenser, of course, is made out of aluminum, and the engine block is also. So the deionized water keeps from the polarity of electrolysis traveling through the engine, where you'd have any corrosive effects.
So in addition to being an efficient engine, the longevity factor is going to be what compared to internal combustion?
Well, further tests are going to show that.
You know, what do preliminary tests show?
Well, any engine is based on what you would want to manufacture the engine for. If you have an engine as a weed eater, you'd never have the life out of a weed eater. Maybe a weed eater is good for 50 hours. However, industrial equipment has to run 20,000 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, any kind of an engine designed for the specific use of it.
But intrinsically, doesn't the design lend itself to greater longevity?
We think so.
Because you don't have the lubrication fouling issue?
That's the main issue. You don't have particles and contamination in there. And also, water is pretty slippery when it's in the right environment, and most bearings are, as Israel uses a comparison, he always compares it to ice, and that's what the surface of that lubricant is, of course, is water. You use a comparison of, you know, can't compare any lubricant to ice. And actually, in the composite bearing world, water and oil have the same slippery factor, which is 0.04.
You're talking about a system that you have tested. give us an idea of how many prototypes you have built and how long they have run total, and how long one has run continuously in one setting without stopping?
Well, we don't run them that long for to run them continuously and continuously. We're always continually tearing them down and checking them and putting them together, and because it's a continual process of evolution. We're still at the model stage era in this engine development. You know, there's been 100 years of development, of course, on an internal combustion engine, and we're at 2.5 years on this basic engine. So we had several hours on it, of course, but we also have gone through 20 different designs of pistons and connecting rods and different shapes of heads and the combustion chambers and the materials we build things out of, and all these materials are changed.
Have you arrived at a design that you're ready to take to market?
We're probably about 8 months away from the two-cylinder 10kW generator.
So when people show an interest in your system, how much interest has places like Detroit and others shown in your system?
Actually, quite a bit. We have correspondence going with some of those folks. And we'll be showing this engine in Detroit in the middle of April in the SAE show in Detroit.
I noticed on your website you have a couple of awards cited. One was an SAE 2006. What was that?
Yeah, that was the Tech Award. We had an award for the technology of the engine, because you can see it's quite unique. And, of course, we're watching all the time to see if someone else has a new technology that might be better than what we have. But so far, we feel like we're on the top of the heap. Everything out there has gotten to be so complicated, or they're still using an internal combustion engine, which we call a suck-squeeze-bang engine, with a different kind of a crank mechanism, some kind of a swash plate or a woggle plate or something of that sort. But an internal combustion engine, all the numbers still come out the same.
On our website, we have a fairly exhaustive listing of alternative engine designs, both at freeenergynews.com and at peswiki.com, peswiki.com. Down the left-hand side, you'll see a list of topics, and then one is engines, alphabetically listed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole lot of really clever approaches to greater efficiency, smaller size, greater horsepower, etc., similar to what you're describing. I'm wondering how much you've looked at what other designs are out there in comparison, because it sounds like from your comment just now that you've only looked at primarily internal combustion designs and not maybe some of these more outside-the-box designs that maybe don't get as much attention in the mainstream press.
Well, there might be something that can squeak by, but we haven't seen any external combustion that is in the field that we are.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what we have, we've got the patents that came through on this engine, and there wasn't anything close to it. Of course, external combustion. I did an internal combustion about 14 years ago at one of the large manufacturers was interested in. They sent down a couple engineers, and they analyzed it and thought it was a nice motor, and we thought we had it sold to them, but it turned out what they were looking for at the time was a clean air engine, and this was an internal combustion engine of a more compact configuration. So that isn't what you're looking for if you're looking for a clean air engine, so we felt there was only one route to take to get a clean air engine, and that was external combustion. We carried external combustion a little bit farther by burning fuel in a centrifuge instead of just shooting in a straight line.
Where does the name Cyclone come from? Is that part of the design, and is that part of the efficiency?
Well, we're spinning the fuel, and we spin in the condenser section, the lower cooling section. So everything in the engine is kind of in a spin, so we called it a cyclone. And, of course, it does have a resemblance to the airplane engines of the old Pratt & Whitney Cyclone is similar.
We posted a picture of one of those on the, we created a feature page for your technology at PezWiki.
Mm-hmm.
I put that up there a couple of days ago, and somebody who used to fly those engines posted a picture of one on the website,
mm-hmm.
and it looks very similar to your design, what you have in your patent.
Well, if I can explain the difference, they were wonderful engines, there's no question about it. But you'll notice they were always in an odd number of cylinders. And the reason being is they had a what's called a master rod. The connecting rods, one main connecting rod, had all of the other connecting rods tied into it. So they couldn't run an opposing rod to that master rod because the connecting rod angle would have been too high of a degree angle. And what also happens is that there's a slight imbalance of the engine itself with the master rod, so we invented what's called a spider bearing in our engine. And the spider bearing always keeps an XY axis as it rotates, and then all of the connecting rods are exactly equal. Everything is the same all the way around, and that's what's different in the Cyclone as compared to the old airplane engine. Except they are in a radial configuration, and in all engineering books, that's the smallest and most compact means of making an engine. You only have two main bearings, and then your balance is absolutely perfect, especially by having the spider bearing where all the rods are exactly equal.
So you've been able to get a symmetry, whereas the Whitney didn't have the symmetry.
No. That's true. And what we also do with the spider bearing, because operating it's super critical, see, we got 3,200 PSI on the piston. For an internal combustion engine, your expansion pressure is about 1,000 PSI. So you can see they're pretty high brake mean effective pressures occurring on this, so it takes a very, very high bearing load. So what in the spider bearing and also in the top of the piston, in the piston we have what we call a shoe bearing, and the spider bearing is on the crank, and it's a bearing that goes around the outside of the connecting rod, so it has a bearing on the inside of the wrist pin and the journal, and also a bearing around the outside of the connecting rod so we could double up the bearing area.
Let's talk for a minute about price. I know it may be a bit too early to know exactly what you're going to be in at price-wise, but where would your engine compare price-wise to an internal combustion engine that it would be replacing in an automobile?
Well, we think we're going to have a very distinct advantage. Now, we're not going to manufacture this engine at all. What we're doing is just developing the technology, and the technology be licensed to different industries, you know, automotive and trucks and everything from weed eaters to ship engines to trains and things like that. But competitively in an automobile, it's so many things that you leave off. There's so many electronics that aren't necessary. Transmission that's not necessary, radiator that's not necessary, muffler not necessary, and the basic engine is smaller and lighter. You have less material in the basic engine, and it's much, much easier to machine, and so many less parts.
In your in your business plan, what kind of numbers are you looking at for what that equates to in the bottom line cost of the engine and the installation of the engine in an automobile? I'm using automobile as a frame of reference, but something that we can compare an existing system compared to yours, are we looking at 50% cost, 80% the present cost, what?
That would be a pretty hard thing. We haven't done quite an analysis of that, but we have one engine that's mounted on a differential. The differential came out of a Nissan, and a set of wheels. The engine with the differential and the wheels weighs just slightly more than 500 pounds, and it could just be a plug-in unit. So, I mean, it's a very, very compact, very simple part. You'd almost have to have a bill of materials of a particular automobile and go down through it and, extract one from another one to see what it would be, but it would be substantial. I would imagine at least half.
Imagine as you get closer to going to market, you'll want to have those kinds of numbers ready.
Well, I don't think so. Like I said, we're just developing the technology. And we'll be doing some test vehicles. We have some engines planned to go in some boats and some cars and things like that, and some generators. And the generator will be evidently the first Cyclone to go into manufacture. But, of course, we won't be the manufacturer. We're only the developer. See, what we do is it will go to a licensee. And the military, of course, is very interested in what we're doing, especially in the small compact generators. And also because of the multi-fuel capability.
What's the noise signature on this thing?
Very quiet. The loudest part of the engine is you can hear the combustor, and it has a ooh sound like that, like a furnace would be. That's the closest thing I can tell you. And the blower itself, which would be comparable to a fan and a radiator. But there's no exhaust roar at all.
You say there's no exhaust noise?
No, there's no exhaust noise. It has no real exhaust. It just has... Now, the exhaust comes out at a very low temperature. Either exhaust temperature, instead of 1,000 degrees, as would be expected from an internal combustion engine, your exhaust temperature is only 350 degrees. Because all that heat is regenerated.
Mm-hmm. What kind of reductions are you getting in the emissions coming out?
Emissions, of course, that depends on what type of fuel you use. But nitrous oxide is a given. It just almost doesn't exist. It's very, very small because nitrous oxide is not normally formed until you get above 2,300 degrees. And we keep our combustion chambers temperatures below 2,000 degrees, so nitrous oxide doesn't happen. Particulate emissions are like carbon particles. Now, you can imagine an internal combustion engine, any particulate emission, you never get a burn because the true fact is if you move the exhaust pipe off of a car, you'll see a flame coming out. So you can see that it hasn't done its complete combustion process, and in a millisecond, you just can't burn everything up. So carbon particles and a lot of other things come out, depending on the fuel you use. And diesel is actually far worse than most people know. There's a chemical that's formed in diesel exhaust called benzopyrene. Benzopyrene is a plastic particle, and it's formed under high compression and temperature. And what it is, it's a carcinogen 20 times worse than cigarette smoke. So diesel exhaust is pretty bad stuff. And people don't realize it and how much it is, and there's not much much attention brought to benzopyrene. And it's, the plastic particle that it produces is molecule size. It's the size of a gas molecule, so it's something that can't be filtered out. So those are the things that, by comparison, we burn up all the particles. Even if you run an engine, like when we're doing a test engine, and you run it to the point that you're making smoke on purpose, it can where you can slip the outer wall of the combustion chamber. When you turn it to the right air-fuel mixture, what it does is pretty soon you'll see all the carbon that was on that wall is totally burned off. It just cleans it off like you washed it, like a self-cleaning oven. And the flame front is so long that you have enough time to burn the particles.
So the burn cycle in your engine is much longer?
Oh, well, of course. You got milliseconds for a burn in a internal combustion engine. I mean, it has a length of a time that it ignites and pushes a piston down. Maybe you got a 3-inch stroke, so your flame front had to travel 3.5, maybe 4 inches if it's a big engine, and went out the exhaust pipe. In ours, it has to go probably 6 feet. It travels all the way around in the centrifuge. So you're traveling 74 inches, and it can keep on continuing until that particle that's laid against the outer wall is burned. It doesn't have to go through at all until it's finally consumed. You can go to an area that's pretty dirty, a lot of dirt in the air, and pull it in, and pretty soon what's coming out is cleaner out the exhaust than what went in the intake.
In looking at the shape of a Cyclone, we typically, if we were to make it a comparison to a draining bathtub, for example, the particles are starting on the exterior, and they flow faster and faster till they go down to the very center of the vortex. Is that the same action, or is it the opposite in your system?
Well, the particles are on the outer wall, but the heat goes through the center. It's not slowing down because heat goes up, of course. But the particles would stay to the outer wall because that's your direction of gravity. It's not quite like going down a drain. It's a little bit more like the motorcycle guy folks that used to ride in a barrel, you know, running around on the inside of a barrel, mm-hmm. where they could stay against the outside of the barrel. Well, when the particle is heavy and unburned, it always stays to the outer wall. And then when you finally burn it up and it's light enough, then it can go through the heat exchanger, which is towards the center.
Back to the question about people showing an interest in this design. Do you have the money that you need right now to do your research and development, or are you looking for funding?
Oh, we're always looking for funding. We've done this... Right now, we've done it out of our own pocket and through some close friends. So, and that's basically been it. Right now, we're looking at doing a public offering, and because we are, of course, want to make this project move a lot faster. We're very, very small, and we've done it with just a very, very small group of people here.
Is there a particular kind of money that you're looking for? You mentioned public offering. Are there any other models that you're considering in terms of people who are looking to invest?
We're looking right now at about $5 million, and that will pull us quite a bit faster into a demonstrator automobile and the generator into closer to a production type version. And other engines, we have drawings on engines up to 300 horsepower, and we have some that are sizes that are small, so small you can put them in the palm of your hand. We're thinking about there's some field generators that might need to be used to power computers and things like that that are just very, very tiny, and things that are big enough to power ships. Now, we have some of the preliminary drawings on them, and I don't think we're going to have to go much farther than probably the 300 horsepower engine before the licenses are sold out. We have a licensee at the present time, an Advent Corporation, who is licensed to sell generators to the military. And at the present time, they're already working on a military contract for a small, real compact 10 kW generator. Even smaller in size than the normal 10 kW that you would see on our website.
What got you started in this?
I've never liked the smell of diesel exhaust. You know, we designed a lot of boats and everything, and the diesel exhaust is pretty choking. And I always thought that there was a problem with a compressor that's always pumping out some pretty foul air. And living in South Florida, it's been pretty clean here because we always have a nice breeze that blows off the ocean and keeps it clean. And going to other cities, you know, you see that some of them are pretty nasty. Well, after a lot of experimentation on this engine, we know, my God, we're on the right track here, because we went down to the boat show. I live in Pompano Beach, and going across the expressway, here we are coming into Miami, and here's this dome over the top of the city. Just a nasty gray cloud. And going in after the experiment with all these fuels, I could recognize the fuels in this cloud. So I understand that there's about 8,300 lung-related deaths, traceable to diesel exhaust fumes. And you get in congested areas, and it's pretty bad. It really is. And there's so many other health hazards that are caused by all of this, and also having to use the standard fuels that we're kind of stuck and regulated to. And of course, the cheapest thing that you can use in any engine is what they drill a hole in the ground and pump it out. But we're certainly victims to people that aren't our friends.
I should mention there's an inventor, perhaps you heard of him, called Silminder Singh, S-I-N-G, or S-H-I-N-G, I think. He's in India. And he's come up with a way of basically you take the head off the engine and you, if I understand right, you actually bore a channel into the top of the cylinder, and it creates a vortex action of the fuel as it's coming in to be burned in the cylinder. And he gets a significant improvement in mileage just from doing that. And so do you think that action, the cyclone action, how much of that is crucial or contributing to your efficiency?
Well, that's not what we're doing at all, because any time that's a still what we call a suck, squeeze, bang engine, you can get little tiny gains, but basically, in the end, a gasoline engine burns 8% of the horsepower in gallons per hour per horsepower. Diesels burn 5.5% on the smaller diesels, and they'll get up to like 0.48 in some really big diesels, you know, big marine diesels. But basically, that's where you are. And the efficiency has to do with what's called the clearance volume. So if he bored something just to get a better fuel mix or something like that, there's a lot of ways of mixing the air and the fuel. A carburetor really does a pretty good job by atomization. In fact, in my opinion, it does a better job than fuel injection. However, fuel injection is timed better, and it doesn't have to have an accelerator pump, where in a carburetor you have to push on a plunger and it shoots raw gas into an engine, which is not a good thing. But any of these devices that are accelerate to an internal combustion engine, you still have suck, squeeze, bang, and it still has to follow the same laws of physics. And if you fire under compression, you have high heat, and the heats are higher than the formation of nitrous oxide. And you have the other particles that occur under diesel. And if you have low compression engines, if you have a large volume space in there, the gap between the top of the piston and the head, you have low efficiencies. There's just no way to get around it. You have to fill that space every time. And that's a lot to fill with fuel and air. And that becomes part of your expansion. You have a thing called expansions. In other words, that's that gap times how many times it goes down the piston. And if it's the smaller that gap is, the higher the compression ratio, the more efficient the engine is. However, also the higher the compression ratio, the higher the temperatures, the dirtier the engine is, the more nitrous oxides that are formed. And these engines, basically, they are, you know, so many of them, they keep bragging about what their efficiencies are. But every time we deal with them, you look at a dyno chart, you say, oh yeah, let me pull out this dyno chart from 20 years ago. And it's pretty close. Maybe a couple of percentage points they've cleaned up, but it's still basically the same. 8% on the internal combustion engine, and 0.48 on the bigger ones, and 0.55 on the little ones, on diesel.
Is it conceivable that you could use your engine in a solar application, such as a Stirling engine, basically Stirling systems, I think they're called, where they use solar concentrator mirrors to focus the sun's energy onto a Stirling engine to then get your rotation torque that then is connected to a generator to generate electricity?
Oh, yeah. Anything that generates heat. You can do it from solar collectors, absolutely. Absolutely.
So you could plug your system into the Stirling system that I just described, and
a Stirling engine is basically what we are. It's a heat engine. And most any heat engine will work on solar or anything that makes heat if it's a heat engine. And the difference between ours and a Stirling engine is a pretty efficient engine because it's a heat exchange engine. But it's extremely big, extremely expensive, has to operate at high pressure gases to have any real level of efficiency, and slightly compact size. But they're basically constant speed engines. They don't like variations up and down like an automobile engine has to move. So we, you know, we have the high variations in speed where you can go from 1 RPM up to 3,600 RPM in a matter of a second. Where a Stirling engine is quite a slow process of moving up and down because it's a heat exchange engine. It has to move through displacer pistons to move the hot air or the hot high compressed gases from one side of a displacer piston to the other side.
Yeah, Stirling Energy Systems, I think, is in process of installing some utility scale plants in California and elsewhere of several hundred megawatts. So they're looking at many, many acres of these things, and so it's a big operation. Mm-hmm. You might want to get in touch with them because your design could help bring their price down even more, because as it is right now, their system is going to be comparable to coal, natural gas, and other power plant systems. They're going to be at a price point generating electricity commercially that is competitive. They don't require tax incentives in order to make it. And with your engine in place of the Stirling engine, it could give them yet an additional advantages. Do you think you're far enough along to have those kinds of conversations?
Probably so. Probably so. We have the engine. Our engine is very simple thermodynamically. You can go through the cycles on it. We have PV diagrams, and you can see what the horsepower output is and what BTUs it is to go through the heat exchangers. And of course, it's more compact, less costly, and the engine design that has a vertical shaft, and the advantage to that is you can set them on line shafts. You can put one long shaft and just plug engines onto the shaft through a bevel gear. So, you know, it makes it quite feasible.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The Stirling engine is a nice, efficient, clean engine. I mean, there's no question about it, but of course, the handicaps it does incur, it's quite expensive and quite bulky.
Is that why the Stirling engine has not made it into the automobile and other markets?
Yes, that's exactly it. I think Ford even had one operating back in the 70s or something like that, or maybe the 80s, they had an experimental one. But it was just too big and bulky. You had very, very small amount of horsepower for such a huge engine. And it was complicated to build. It just had a lot of handicaps to it, even though it did some things right, but not everything. And that's why we went into the a working cycle using deionized water through a series of heat exchangers to recapture the heat losses. And that way we were able to build an engine that's extremely compact and lightweight.
Let's talk for a second about the ramifications of being able to use any fuel and not having to use some expensive processes that we require in our, that we have the unleaded and premium gasoline at our filling stations. If we didn't have to go through those steps, what would it amount to in terms of, number one, the savings in fuel, and number two, the emissions to the environment?
Oh, those are the two big advantages. Fuel savings, of course, you don't have to have fuel that is nearly as highly refined. I don't know all of the ramifications of the sulfur. We might be able to burn the sulfur as you would in a power plant, but I'm not sure. I'm not going to speak on that. I'm not much of an expert on that. But most of the other fuels, because of the combustion process, of course, you wouldn't need the refining or the additives in the fuel, because we don't use fuel as a lubricant. Like in a diesel, they've taken the sulfur out of the diesel, and the sulfur was a lubricant for the fuel injection pump. So they're having a lot of problems with that, and they've had to, with the biofuels, they're having to do a lot of maintenance, extra maintenance on fuel filters and things like that.
What would the fuel filter requirement be on your system?
Just a regular filter, just to keep any crap out. The filter, well, the fuel injector is quite a bit different. The nozzle orifice on the fuel injector is 30 thousandths in diameter, where the injectors in the diesel, they're very, very, very fine orifices for the fuel to come out of. Well, this thing here, we've got some of it, it'll run even powdered fuel through it. On some tests, if you have some very, very fine powdered coal that's absolutely dry, you can actually run that through it.
Sure.
So, you're not going to do anything like that of any of the nature, but it doesn't require anything that takes any real fine, but just a regular fuel filter would be fine.
Is it conceivable that in some places you could use even like wood, like have a trunk full of chopped up wood that you put into a hopper that would run the engine?
Well, anything that produces heat. However, in that condition, you don't have the control burning raw refuge like that. It'd be fine, better for a generator. I was trying to run this injector yesterday on some really, really fine sawdust, but it was too big of particles in it and plugged up my fuel injector. But, you know, sometimes you try a little bit of everything. So we did try some much finer particles in the powder, like a talcum powder would be. So if you had coal dust in the form of a talcum powder size, you could conceivably burn that. But
let's talk for a minute about
separate incinerator and pipe the heat to the engine.
Let's talk for a minute about some applications. What kinds of could you use this for a home heat? For a home generator to make power at home? Could you use it for we talked about vehicles, and you talked about the range earlier. Anything from a weed eater to a train. What are some of the applications that maybe are not as obvious that this thing could fit?
Well, some of these things are coming up every day. Some generator vehicles, we feel that automobiles and SUVs and things like that, of course, will have their own little onboard generators. So we can see that small little compact generator being able to run your computers and television, things like that, because, of course, automobiles have expanded more than just something to take you from point A to point B. Like I said, the weed eaters, and I believe that a lot of these small engines are not even allowed to go into California anymore. And I guess the two-stroke engines that pump out a lot of unburned fuel and oil and their lubrication, they're going to be a thing of the past. And that was the compact engine, and we're looking at engines of the same size and a size of a Cyclone as a two-stroke.
So when you go down to a smaller size, are you going to also need to reduce complexity in order to also get a good price point for the smaller applications?
Yes, that's exactly right. We have a different valve mechanism that we use on the smaller engine. We don't get as high of efficiency as we do on the larger engines, like the 100 horsepower that you see on automotive. It has a valve mechanism and a cam timing in it and things like that, and that gives us the higher thermal efficiency, because we can also operate at the higher temperatures and pressures. But the smaller engines, we operate at a little bit lower pressure and a little lower temperature, and it allows us to use a simpler valve, what you call an automatic valve mechanism. It doesn't need push rods or cams or anything else. It's just the movement of the piston from the top to bottom opens the valve. But you're not going to have quite the efficiency, but if you're comparing it to a weed eater, that's pretty poor efficiency, but it would be better than that. And of course, as you get smaller, we wouldn't use quite as much heat exchange in it, because the complication is not worth the fuel savings on it.
So it's the opposite end of the spectrum. While going the smaller side, you go more simple. Would you likewise get a little more complex with a larger system, say for a power plant, so that you optimize the reduction of any emissions? And you have a continuously running system as opposed to an automobile where you have a governing up and down and whatnot.
Well, actually, in big generators, it would be a simpler system than an automobile. Automobiles are a little bit more complicated in the camming and the throttling. Big generators would use a more sophisticated technology, of course, than the little tiny engines, but it wouldn't really even have to be quite as sophisticated as the automotive engine. Because you don't have to deal with accelerations, you would deal with a constant torque. You know, you want to have a system that keeps the engine governed at a constant speed.
What about CHP, combined heat and power systems, where you're using the heat that is typically blown off into the environment as part of the regenerative side, not regenerative, but you've got it, what was the word you used earlier?
It's a heat regeneration cycle, yes.
Is there enough heat left over still to be able to use for to pull that heat off for heating the building?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the lower section that comes out of the condenser is clean heat. It's not exposed to any combustion gases. The upper temperature that comes out of combustion gases, you would have a combustion gas that's cleaner than what comes out of a space heater. But even that is still combustion gases. The air that comes out of the condenser is absolutely clean air, because that's like you'd be coming off of a radiator. That temperature of that air is in the range of 120 degrees or so. And you could directly pipe that anywhere to heat a building or heat the inside of your car or anything. And the 350-degree air, of course, you could go through a heat exchanger and reuse that again. Incidentally, this engine here, in a small size, you could connect it to the exhaust on an internal combustion engine. Well, if you looked at an internal combustion engine at, say, a 25% thermal efficiency, if you piped this engine, a small engine, on here, you would be at the point that you could save another 6% on the total thermal efficiency.
Because would it be worth the cost?
Say the 33% waste heat coming out of an internal combustion engine, and you would, in a, going through the heat process, you'd probably save another 20% of the 33%. So you could save another 6%. A 100-horsepower engine would gain about 6 horsepower or so in heat regeneration.
Well, Harry, we are to the end of our 55-minute segment. I do appreciate you joining us. Do you have any quick comments at the end, things that we've not covered?
I think you did quite a good job.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you joining us. This has been Sterling Allen, your host, with Harry Scholl of Cyclone Engines. Your website address is?
www.cyclonepower.com. Please visit us.
And you'll also find, if you type in Cyclone Technologies, our coverage will be coming up right after your website here pretty soon as Google picks it up. That's typically where we show up. And you can join us every day online at freeenergynews.com. Thanks for joining us for today's show.
Thank you.